offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for anyone to have. Here I am, here you are. Take it slow for now. Here I am, here you are. Take it slow.
Hi, this is Dan Hebert. I'm in the Department of Geography at UBC. I'm also the co-chair of the City of Vancouver Mayor's Working Group on Immigration.
Can you tell us a little bit about what this working group is doing right now?
Well, it's a group that has been in existence for about 7 or 8 years.
Just go ahead.
Today is Friday, the 15th of August. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:14 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings.
We also have an interview with UBC law professor Ben Gould to discuss changes to UBC's security for the coming school year.
And later in the program, we have a report from Valerio De Feo on recent protests against Imperial Metals, the company responsible for the Mount Polly affluent spill. As well as an interview with Daniel Hebert, a UBC geography professor who has been a member of a working group discussing the possibility of Vancouver becoming a sanctuary city.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC Vancouver's Point Grey campus to undergo safety enhancements. The university has issued a release laying out the improvements to campus safety that have been implemented in time for the upcoming winter term. The report outlines improvements like more open, well-lit walking routes created by increased lighting and landscaping, as well as increased campus security patrols and a strengthening of the Alma Mater Society's Safe Walk program. These enhancements were suggested by the Campus Safety Working Group that was established following the series of sexual assaults last year. UBC's new president, Arvind Gupta, added, quote, "UBC's Vancouver campus has been and continues to be a very safe place to live, work, and study, and we are committed to tangible, practical safety improvements." President Gupta also said the university will work, quote, "over the long term on education and community building initiatives. Ultimately, the best crime prevention is a caring, connected, and respectful community."
In local news, Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson has denounced CP Rail for its destruction of Arbutus Community Gardens. This week, CP Rail ripped up community gardens that had been nurtured for years along the disused Arbutus Corridor Railway. Mayor Robertson said that the firm ignored his request for facilitated talks in the decades-old dispute. The City of Vancouver and CP Rail have been in conflict ever since Vancouver refused to allow the development of the Arbutus Corridor, insisting that it remain a greenway. The dispute was eventually brought before the Supreme Court of Canada, which ruled in 2006 that the city had final say over the corridor's development, but that CP maintained the right to use the route for train traffic. Since then, residents used the greenway as public space and constructed many community gardens which had since flourished. Mayor Robertson said today that, quote, "This week's removal and destruction of the long-standing structures along the Arbutus Corridor is completely unwarranted, and these actions are simply a bullying tactic." CP announced it would be clearing the rail line in May, asking the community gardeners to clear the tracks by the end of July. The deadline came and went, with gardeners refusing to remove anything, but CP proceeded anyway. Mayor Robinson added that there was no business case to reactivate cargo trains along the Arbutus corridor, and that, quote, the city offered to purchase the land at fair market value, but CP rejected the offer.
In national news, a draft of the upcoming Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement between Canada and the European Union has been leaked. The alleged final drafts of the agreement, also known as the CETA or CETA, were leaked on Thursday and may have a big impact on local businesses. Canadian businesses and products often rely on taxation of goods and services originating from outside the country, in the form of tariffs. CETA is a free trade agreement allowing European companies and products to compete in Canada. According to the leaked documents, the Canadian government will be prohibited from requiring companies to procure their supplies and equipment locally, except in very low amounts. This means the Canadian government cannot mandate local buying, effectively undermining the recent buy local movements. Similarly, CETA will allow the Canadian government to mandate a certain percentage of women or minorities in a company's staff, but forbids forcing a company to have a certain number of local or Canadian workers. Both the European Union and Canada will likely see benefit from CETA, but the agreement's anti-protectionist policies seem to benefit European businesses more than Canadian ones.
And in international news, an armored column was attacked by Ukrainian military within its borders. The Ukrainian government reported this morning that its artillery had destroyed part of a Russian armored column that entered the country overnight. Simultaneously, Ukraine said that its forces came under shell fire from Russia. The Russian government denies any of its forces having crossed into Ukraine, calling the report some kind of fantasy, and accused Ukraine of sabotaging efforts to relieve eastern areas torn by fighting. In addition, Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said that Russia was seriously concerned by the increased activity of U.S.-led NATO forces in the region and called for a ceasefire to get aid into the Ukraine. NATO has itself reported a Russian incursion into Ukraine, but avoided calling it an invasion. The United Nations has stated it has received no reports from the border, but immediately called for a de-escalation of the situation. As a member of NATO, the Canadian government continues to stand by Ukraine's assertions that Russia is arming and destabilizing the region. But it is unclear whether the armored column was officially part of the Russian army or in active service. If evidence of such activities would clearly give force to the allegations of Russia's involvement in the violence.
And in more international news, Canada will support Kurdish forces in Iraq. Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced today that Canadian military planes will be ferrying weapons and munitions to Kurdish militants battling Islamic jihadists in northern Iraq. The flights will begin in a few days, with roughly 30 Canadian Forces ground personnel servicing the two military airlifters temporarily deployed to the region. In his statement, Prime Minister Harper stressed that Canada will only be delivering and not providing the arms and ammunition. The equipment will be from the United States, France, and Britain. Kurdish Peshmerga forces are currently defending a 1,000-kilometer front against radical Sunni extremists, Islamists who have seized an area the size of Belgium in northern Iraq, according to the Globe and Mail. Quote, this support, which will be provided in close coordination with our allies, will enable Kurdish forces to provide effective protection to Iraqis faced with the barbarous attacks, Mr. Harper said. Quote, Canada remains committed to providing assistance to the thousands of Iraqi children, women, and men, including Yazidis and Christians, who desperately need it. Those are your campus, local, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA. Nope. We're going to go straight into our interview with UBC law professor Ben Gould to discuss changes to UBC's security for the coming year. Professor Gould, thank you for being with us.
All right. So this is Morgan Yee, the news director here. It's nice to have you with us today. My first question for you is if you can explain what your role has been in the working group on improving UBC security.
The Campus Safety Working Group earlier in the year. The group was brought together in response to the sexual assaults we had throughout 2013 to look at what we're doing about campus safety and security and making sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure everybody on campus is as safe as they could be.
And so what kind of improvements have you guys been looking at?
So we've looked at a range of things, sort of short, medium, and long term. In terms of the things that you're going to see over the coming months, we've put a lot of investment into lighting and landscaping, really looking carefully at how we can make the campus more open, better lit, and make sure people feel comfortable moving around the campus. We're very aware of the fact it's a very, very large campus spread over about 1,000 acres, and we have approximately 60,000 people on campus on any given day. So it's really important that people feel comfortable moving around that space. We're also working with the AMS on strengthening the Safe Walk program, providing extra support for that. There'll be better coverage. There'll be vehicular transportation as well as just the traditional walking. And we're also putting a lot of time and effort into developing mobile applications that will link with the Blue Phone system to give students direct connection to campus security and other resources.
Now, in terms of these improvements you guys have been looking at, have there been other schools that have worked with these practices?
Yeah, these are not unusual practices across Canadian and U.S. campuses, and actually campuses across the world. Most campuses take a fairly holistic, comprehensive approach to these issues. It's rare for any one particular policy or approach to be sort of an overall solution. And what we've been looking at, as other campuses have, is making sure we're doing lots of different things that work together well to make it a safe and secure place to be.
So I'm curious to know if there were any studies undertaken last year or over the summer looking at whether students' perceptions of how safe campus, the UBC campus is, whether that's changed after the string of the 6 sexual assaults last year.
So that's a great question. We've had a lot of input from individual students, student leaders, student groups and the like over the last 6 months to a year. People are obviously concerned. I think the sexual assaults really left people very worried and distressed, and they were very challenging for our community. I think one of the things we've been emphasizing when we've been discussing these things with students and others is that UBC has always been a very safe campus and it continues to be a very safe campus. We all need to be thoughtful about our personal safety here, just like anywhere else in Vancouver. But our key message has been that UBC is still a very, very safe place to study, work, and live.
Okay. Now, in terms of UBC security just in general, how often are security changes looked at? Are they looked at something like every few years, or is this something special because of the sexual assaults?
So there's always, we're always looking at campus safety and security year on, year out. Campus Security releases an annual report every year. We have a close working relationship with the RCMP detachment near UBC. Mm-hmm. So we've always got these things under review. Obviously, the sexual assaults last year brought particular attention to our policies, procedures and approaches. And so that was the reason why the working group was struck. And that working group was going to continue its work over the coming years. We think we've learned a great deal over the last year, and we're really keen to capitalize on that and make sure that we're doing everything we can.
And now, what was the cost of the changes that are being put in place?
So the first round of changes that I described earlier, the lighting, strengthening the Safe Walk program, mobile applications, and also looking at our CCTV networks, that's going to come to roughly $1 million.
Okay.
Approximately $750,000 of that is towards lighting, landscaping, and improving the physical environment. Another $250,000 is being devoted to things like the mobile application, education around campus, and also looking at the viability of expanding our CCTV networks.
Okay, now in terms of spreading the word around campus,
yeah.
Last year there'd been posters put up advertising for women to not walk alone, and this sparked a lot of outrage within a lot of the women's groups on campus who claimed that these kinds of warnings were sexist and patriarchal, that they weren't being mindful of taking care of all the students on campus. It was specifically targeting women. Have you guys put any thought into how to spread the word of, you know, just being mindful of your personal safety without running into these kinds of issues?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, since the sexual assaults took place, one of our key concerns has been to make sure we're providing students, faculty, staff with the sort of information and resources they need to make personal, informed choices about their own safety in and around the campus. And we listened very carefully to the concerns that came back to us about the messaging around walking alone. Those concerns were expressed in some really thoughtful ways. It was great to get that feedback from our community. And we've really thought carefully about how going forward we can make sure that we strike a language that gives people the information they need, but in no sense ever gives the sense that we should be blaming victims or focusing on particular groups and making them responsible in the way that I think people were concerned about. We're really concerned to make sure UBC is a safe and secure campus for everybody, and that victims are not blamed at UBC at all, but rather everyone is aware of the fact that we're doing all that we can.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
It was great having you on air, and hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks very much. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to take a quick PSA break, and we'll be right back after that.
Please remember to watch.
I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10. Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here, God, ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Ugh.
Isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotusland Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
News 101. Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Environment Canada. So tonight, partly cloudy, 30% chance of showers early this evening, 60% chance of showers before the morning, and a low of 17 degrees. On Saturday, mainly cloudy, 60% chance of showers in the morning, a high 24, and UV index of 5, or moderate. And Saturday night will be a few clouds with a low of 16. Sunday is looking sunny with a high of 23 degrees. Monday also sunny, low of 15, but a high of 24. Tuesday, a mix of sun and cloud with a 40% chance of showers, low of 16, high of 22. And Wednesday, mix of sun and cloud, low 16, high 23. Thursday, looking sunny again, low 16, high 22. And that's your weather by Environment Canada. Thank you.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Welcome, listeners. Today, we're going to talk about a conference that was held in Vancouver.
two items about global warming and some more items on astronomy. In the first news, Vancouver this week hosted the SIGGRAPH 2014 conference. Our mayor, everyone's favorite mayor, Mayor Greger, on Monday called this the biggest conference Vancouver has ever hosted. The conference dealt with breakthroughs in emerging technologies such as virtual reality and 3D printing. It brought together the world's biggest graphics, animation, and visual effects companies. In 2011, Vancouver hosted this conference, the SIGGRAPH conference, and it was the first city outside of the U.S. to host this conference. Now, in 2014, the SIGGRAPH conference comes at a time when Microsoft, Amazon, and Sony ImageWorks are increasing their presence in Vancouver. Our mayor, Greger, said, and quote, "This conference is so huge for Vancouver. The success of 2011 conference and the increase in technology investment in our city in the past 3 years bodes well for Vancouver's high-tech sector." In the conference, there were 15,000 attendees, including artists, programmers, filmmakers, computer scientists, animators, and game designers. Now, in global warming news, will Hawaii be with us in the future? A prominent scientist, Professor Joanne Levy, the director of the Marine Institute of the University of Hawaii, claims that rising sea levels will not only swallow exotic islands such as Kiribati or the Maldives, but one day these rising waters will inundate Hawaii. Professor Leong she was the lead author of a study titled Hawaii and Pacific Islands, the section of a national climate assessment. The study was a four-year study and included input from over 300 scientists. When the waters rise and areas like American Samoa and Micronesia become vulnerable and possibly vanish due to these rising sea levels, the waters will not only wash away these lands, but will wash away their civilizations, their seaports, their roads, the airports, but also the history and the cultures of these areas. There will be no choice but to evacuate. A group called the Story Group is busy fundraising, trying to raise funds to alert people about global warming. In other environmental news, yes, El Nino is back. Simon Donner, a climate scientist from the University of British Columbia Department of Geography, says El Nino is coming back and it could be warmer than usual and have harsher consequences for the world at large. El Nino usually develops in the equatorial Pacific, and it is caused by a reversal of winds and currents that bring unusually warm waters. There are areas that will benefit from the warm weather, such as Western and Eastern Canada, which will have an unusually dry, mild, and calm winter and spring. The Southern U.S. will be unusually wet, though. But El Nino could be devastating to farmers in South Africa, or Southern Africa, India, Southeast Asia, Australia, and even the Canadian prairies, bringing regional heat and drought. It could be good for California, though, as it could end its 3 years of drought. The warm El Nino waters will choke off food supply and nutrients to the great fisheries off the coast of South America, so there is also a danger to that. Did anybody say supermoon? Yes, we had a supermoon this last week, and it was a brilliant moon. The moon on August 10th, 2014, was the closest and brightest moon of the year. At that point, the moon was at perigee, or at its closest distance to the Earth, which was about 357,000 kilometers. It was a supermoon because the new moon coincided with this perigee. The new moon, one of the effects was that it caused larger than usual tides. There are five supermoons this year, two moons of January, one of July, one in September, but the August moon was the brightest of the year. In other space news, NASA's carbon counter orbiter reaches its final orbit on August 6. The NASA Orbiting Comet, our Carbon Observatory, or OCO2, produced its first test on Papua New Guinea, on the atmosphere of Papua New Guinea, and recorded the bar-like spectra or chemical signatures of molecular oxygen or carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The orbiter is just one of NASA's many ventures, which is looking to measure the carbon dioxide level in the Earth. Atmospheric carbon dioxide is a leading human-produced greenhouse gas responsible for warming the world. It is a critical natural component of Earth's carbon cycle, so OCO2 will produce the most detailed picture to date of sources of carbon dioxide as well as their natural sinks on Earth. The orbiter had to be calibrated in the near 21 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 6 degrees Celsius of space because the mirror of the telescope works best at that temperature. NASA monitors Earth's vital signs from land, air, and space with a fleet of satellites and ambitious airborne and ground-based observatory campaigns. NASA is aiming to share its unique knowledge with the global community and work with institutions around the world to contribute to the understanding and to the protecting of our home planet. Anybody that would like to learn more about this particular spacecraft can go to www.nasa.gov/OCO2. Or for more information about NASA's Earth science activities in 2014, go to www.nasa.gov/earth-right-now. In other space news, the spacecraft Rosetta has reached its rendezvous point. Yes, after 10 years, it has reached Comet 67P/Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Yes, that's right. Churyumov-Gerasimenko, that was discovered by a Russian. The spacecraft made its first tests on the comet, and it is the first spacecraft that will attempt to study a comet this close. It became the first spacecraft to orbit a comet, and the European Space Agency, when it arrived, had to adjust Rosetta's speed and trajectory and gradually match those of the comet. Jean-Jacques Dordain, the European Space Agency General Director, said, after 10 years, 5 months, and 4 days of traveling towards the comet, we are looping around this comet five times and calibrating our instruments, and we will try to land on the comet. Anybody wanting to know more about this can go to www.nasa.gov/Rosetta. And in our final space story, Mars Odyssey spacecraft is now out of danger. A comet, which will fly by Mars in October, could have spelled doom for the Mars Odyssey spacecraft. The spacecraft have been in orbit around Mars for 10 years, but bits of debris from the comet could have damaged the spacecraft. The comet is called Comet C/2013 L Sitting Spring, and its dust particles are traveling so fast that even one hit of one little particle could have doomed the spacecraft. The spacecraft was launched on October 14, 2001. This is Marco. You are up to date with space news. Science and technology news. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Join us on Chips and Dip every second Thursday afternoon, 1 to 2 p.m. with host Hannah Fazio for the freshest local indie pop tracks and upcoming shows at CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. For our next segment,
we have a report from Valerio DeFio on recent protests against Imperial Metals, the company responsible for the Mount Poly affluent spill.
Good evening. Last Monday, 4 days ago, August 11th, at 2 p.m. from Vancouver Public Library, downtown, the Central Library, corner of Robson and Homer, the SAC Webmatch Women's Warrior Society has called this action against Imperial Metals. The recent tailings pond breach and toxic spill disaster by Imperial Metals in the Caribou region sent a slurry-like mixture of 10 million cubic meters of water and more than 4 million cubic meters of fine sediment into Poly Lake, Aztline Creek, and into Quesnel Lake. This has huge devastating impacts on drinking water quality and salmon runs. This is one of the most disastrous environmental events, a result of unfettered access to mining companies to unceded indigenous lands. That's why on Monday, hundreds of people take part of this protest in downtown Vancouver. They march from the Central Library to Bouvard Street under the office of this company to protest against this disaster. Imperial Metals operates the Mount Poly tailings pond. Imperial Metals has a number of other proposed projects, including Radock Creek project, which is located near Tom Tom Lake in the headwaters of the Upper Adams River. The project is in the advanced stage of exploration, but has not obtained the consent of Nesconleth for current or any future activities. The SAC Webpack territory includes the Adams River watershed, home to the world's largest sockeye salmon run, and the location of Imperial's Radock Creek lead and zinc project. The area is of great importance to the Nesconleth, who continue to use and occupy the area for hunting, gathering, education, and ceremonies. In addition to being the headwaters of the Adams River, the area is also home to Threatened Mountain Caribou and Grizzly Bear populations. Imperial Metals is also planning two mining projects in Clayoquot Sound, Catface Mountain, Chatapi, in Howshat territory, contains low-grade copper molybdenum ore. Catface Mountain Mine is a mountaintop removal scheme that would take place only 3 kilometers from the village of Howshat. Fandora, a potential gold mine, would be at the head of Tranquil Valley on Tlaoquitat territory, for which the provincial government is currently reviewing an application for exploration. They have not consulted with the Tlaoquitat territory, who are opposed to mining in their homelands.
Thank you, Valerio, for that report. Next up on the show, we have an interview with Daniel Hibert, a UBC geography professor who is the director of the Canadian Network for Research on Terrorism, Security, and Society, which is focused on the intersection between national security policy and human rights, and has been a member of a working group discussing the possibility of Vancouver considering becoming a sanctuary city.
Hi, this is Dan Hebert. I'm in the Department of Geography at UBC. I'm also the co-chair of the City of Vancouver Mayor's Working Group on Immigration.
Can you tell us a little bit about what this working group is doing right now?
Well, it's a group that has been in existence for about 7 or 8 years, I suppose, and we have been commissioned by three different mayors of Vancouver over those years to get a reading on issues in the City of Vancouver around the question of immigration and to give advice and recommendations in the first instance to the mayor's office, but sometimes to City Council as a whole, about what the City of Vancouver ought to be doing to be as welcoming as possible to immigrants. As I say, we've been meeting over a number of years about that that kind of mandate, and in the past year we have been considering the issue of the Sanctuary City movement and whether Vancouver should join the dozens of cities around the world that have declared themselves as sanctuary cities.
Announcing that you are a sanctuary city, what does that actually entail?
Well, there's the theory and there's the reality, I suppose you could say.
So in theory,
yeah,
what would that
theory,
be?
It entails that people, that all people living in the city have the right to remain in that city, and that their legal status with respect to visas and so forth would not be relevant in terms of whether or not they're allowed to live in that city. That's the sort of ideal of the sanctuary city movement, but at the same time, cities actually don't have jurisdiction over many of the things that might make people's residence precarious in a city. So in many cases, the practice of sanctuary city doesn't match the theory of sanctuary city.
Right, because as you've mentioned before in email correspondence, border services are not part of a city's jurisdiction, things like that. How does that translate legally when a government service running in a city finds out that someone is in the city illegally?
Well, the jurisdiction over the border of Canada rests with the Canadian Border Services Agency, and that's part of Public Safety Canada. And that agency has the responsibility of protecting Canada's borders, and they choose how to interpret that particular responsibility of theirs. If the Canadian Border Services Agency feels that somebody ought to be apprehended and deported from Canada, they have the right to issue a warrant for that to happen. They have the right for their own enforcement people to find that person or to rely on the services of city police or RCMP to execute that warrant. Under Canadian law, once a warrant like that has been issued, all police services must abide by it. So, you know, a jurisdiction like the City of Vancouver could not, for example, say to the City of Vancouver police, oh, by the way, when there's a warrant to apprehend somebody who's an undocumented person in Canada, don't execute it. That's not allowed. City police would then be breaking Canadian law if they were to try and do that. So that's why I say the City of Vancouver has very limited jurisdiction over issues of residence. What it can do, though, is it can declare its own services to be open to all residents of the City of Vancouver. That's a perfectly rational, reasonable thing within the jurisdiction of the City of Vancouver. And that's really what, in the first instance, this whole issue is about. It's the City of Vancouver examining its practices and asking which, if any, of its services are not available to all residents of Vancouver, and if there are any, and I'm very careful here in the way I put it, because I think there actually may be none. If there are any that are not available to all residents of Vancouver, depending on their immigration status, then the City of Vancouver will consider to change the nature of those services. But I think it's instructive to say, what does this not mean? It does not mean the City of Vancouver will no longer execute the warrants I was talking about. Mm-hmm. It does not mean that people will get free access to health care, because, of course, that's a provincial jurisdiction. It does not mean that children who are in undocumented families in Vancouver will have immediate free access to the Vancouver school system, because the school board operates under a different set of jurisdictions and
right.
rules. So those things aren't in the purview of the City of Vancouver. You know, it can just do what it's allowed to do. I would say there's one way of thinking about this in a broader sense that people might find interesting, and that is that the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration Canada and the Minister of Public Safety Canada both believe very strongly that Canadians do not wish to provide services to people who are here in undocumented status, and justify the policies that they've enacted on these issues by saying that this is what Canadians want. So in considering the idea of free services to all residents of Vancouver, in a way, the City of Vancouver is sending a message to higher levels or higher authorities of government mm-hmm. to say that, okay, so we had a democratic elected government consider the issue, and we've decided that within the City of Vancouver's jurisdiction, we are going to make sure all services are available to all people. So in a way, that kind of challenges the interpretation that Canadians do not wish to offer services to people who are in these kind of circumstances. But the City of Vancouver cannot say, oh, by the way, everyone who lives here is now no longer under any threat from apprehension and deportation. It just can't do that.
Right. Now, in terms of transit police, will that change? A lot of people who are picked up by transit police end up in jail. There's worries about being deported. Would TransLink policies change at all in terms of picking up people who are here yep. illegally?
Yeah, you're quite right that that is an issue. And all the City of Vancouver can do on that particular front is to make a request to TransLink. It has no authority over TransLink. TransLink is under the authority of Metro Vancouver, not the City of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And Metro Vancouver is, was it 23, 24? I always forget the number, but it's a whole bunch of municipalities, yeah. not just one. So, yeah, it's not something that that Vancouver can wave a wand okay. and change.
So thank you very much, Professor.
All right, you're welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. Thank you, Morgan, for that wonderful interview. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Who are you to comment on who I am? What the fuck, man? Fucking prick. Oh yeah? Since when? Who the fuck are you, fool? You'll see. Fucking coward. You're a fucking hater. Fuck out of here. Enjoy hating, you prick. Oh good, you fucking idiot. You fucking with the wrong guy. Sucks to be you. Better watch yourself. Real talk.
Beaver Hour. Tuesdays at 11 p.m. Pacific Standard Time with your host, Emma Rawson.
Rawson. Rawson.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Alex Sarah Davis.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. Today's show was produced by Seher Asaf. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Up next, we've got Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
And today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Have a good weekend.
Hi there, are you tired of listening to the same music day in and day out and want to try something a little different? Well then, how about listening to Asian music? Now, I don't mean it like
Oppan Gangnam Style.
Gangnam Style. Or even like
G-Bass, G-Bass. Oh baby, but she moves, she moves.
I'm talking about a little more like and a little more like and also a little more like and definitely something like so tune in to Asian Wave 101, playing you the best of Chinese and Korean pop, Thursdays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m., only on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is Bia from Graymaker.
This is Sasha Bilotti.
Howdy, folks. We're the Bitterweed Drunk.
This is Zach from Black Breath.
Hi, this is Audie from Broken Bones.
Hello, Vancouver. This is Carolyn Mark.
I'm Water Crime Guide.
This is Dan Mangan.
Hey, this is David Pepke from Denmark.
This is Dylan Ozick from Slingshot.
Hi, this is Dick Valentine from Electric Six.
Hi, everybody. This is Fred Penner on the Radio Waves.
This is Fred Schneider.
This is Colin from GBH.
Hi, this is the Gearing Up Inventors.
Hi, this is Ben Dillo from The Gossip.
Hi, this is Brian from Hellshock.
This is Scruffmouth the Scribe.
I'm Shani from Inepsy.
This is Sab Gray from Iron Cross.
Hey, we're J plus J plus J.
This is Jack Mercer from Jack Mercer and the Whiskey Bandits.
It's James Wood, half of Mega Bear.
This is Jeron Paxton, American musicianer.
This is Swami Bill and the Shameless Weed Hounds from New Orleans, Louisiana, east of the Mississippi.
Hi, this is John Boutte from New Orleans, Louisiana.
This is Jesse Laborde.
I'm Peter Mansbridge.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, also on the web, citr.ca, in UBC, University of British Columbia, in Vancouver, Canada. Have our people contact your people, won't you?
You've been troubled, you've been broke, you've been hungry, no job, no money. The one you love has deserted you. That makes you blue.
Got the blues? Just want to hear some blues? Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5 for Code Blue, right here on CITR 101.